You ain't gonna believe it.
I stood on my tiptoes and looked into our classroom. Mr. Travers didn't usually write nothing on the board till we'd been studying for a while and children had started getting drowsy and droopy. But today, he'd writ across the blackboard in letters big enough that you could have read 'em from Lake Erie in the fog. Familiarity breeds contempt. You could tell Mr. Travers was feeling real strong about this lesson. The words were underlined 3 times, and you could even see that he'd been mashing on the chalk so hard that it had busted clean in two in a couple of places, and he had to commence his underlining all over again. It weren't nothing to imagine Mr. Travers standing at the blackboard after he finished doing this writing, huffing and puffing with his eyes spitting fire. Doggone it all. Maybe Cuda was right. I weren't too confident that he was going to know, but I asked him anyway. So what do those words mean? Cuda said,
You don't know? I was kind of hoping you could tell me. But I done some thinking the way Mr. Travers has been telling us to. I matched up the two of them words I don't know with 2 words that I do know.
What'd you come up with?
Like I said, I ain't got too much a notion what the first word and last word mean. I figure they ain't nothing but some fancy mumbo jumbo. But we both know what that word in the middle means, right?
I must have been looking puzzled.
Cuda said, Eli, you work in the stable? You gotta know what.
He checked over our shoulders again, leaned in real close, and whispered in my ear,
You just gotta know what breeding is, right?
You didn't need to work in no stable to know what breeding is. I said, yeah.
Cuda said, And look at that first word, familiarity. That look a powerful lot like it got something to do with family, don't it?
It does. Cuda said,
And the last word, contempt.
It looks just about the same as contest, right?
I guess so. So what's that all sum up to?
I shook my head. Cuda whispered,
Come on, Eli. Put it all together, and it come up to family breeding contest. He's going to learn us about having a blamed family breeding contest. No. What else could it mean?
Cuda saw I weren't real convinced. He said,
My pa said that Mr. Travers is from New York City and growed up free, and that's 2 reasons what folks should be suspicious about him for. Pa says him and them other grown folks was going to have to keep a sharp eye on what Mr. Travers tried to learn us.
I said, So?
Don't you see, Eli? Ain't no grown folks been checking up on Mr. Travers lately. So he thinks the coast is clear, and it's safe for him to give us some of that stuff what Paul calls up north big city learning mess.
It sounded peculiar at first, but if he started thinking like he didn't have no common sense at all, it seemed like Cuda'd put it all together real good. Cuda saw I was starting to believe and said,
And if family breeding contests don't count as some up north big city learning mess, I don't know what do.
I couldn't help myself from saying, I'll be blamed. I know that's swearing, but compared to what our lesson was going to be about, swearing didn't seem like much of a sin no more.
Cuda said, I just wish he hadn't gone and writ the lesson out on the board like that. What if that doggone Emma Collins or one of them other persnickety girls run off and tell someone what we about to study? What if they stops this before it gets to the real interesting, real nasty parts?
By the time the school bell rung, Cuda had me so worked up that I was looking like I was sitting on a hot stove, too. We both knowed something big was about to happen. Cuz instead of saying his regular, Good morning, scholars, strivers, and questers for a better future. Are you ready to learn? Are you ready to grow? The way he does every other morning, Mr. Travers was sitting at his desk, holding on to his pointing stick. His eyes were closed, and he was so hopping mad that it was a miracle that smoke weren't pouring from his ears. I knowed why, too. He must have figured out that once he taught us about family breeding contests, the grown folks were going to hunt him down and give him a good tar and feathering. I'd heard lots of talk about such things, but had never witnessed it myself. But I knowed if I ever ran into Mr. Travis again after this, I was going to have to apologize for spreading talk that he was a boring teacher. I was going to have to eat my blang words, because couldn't nothing in the world make you want to come to school more than learning about a family breeding contest than watching the teacher that taught it to you get covered in hot tar and run out of the settlement on a rail. We all settled down at our desks and waited. Even the children who didn't know what today's lesson was about sensed something weren't right and started looking at one another all nervous and worrisome. Mr. Travis stood up, and me and Cooter were about to bust with excitedness. Mr. Travis brung that pointing stick down on top of his desk so hard, it was a miracle the desk didn't split clean in two. All the other children were taking this in a very terrific way. They were clenching onto the sides of their desks and looking as afeard as a horse had seen a three-head snake. Excepting for Mr. Travis's heavy breathing and the pointer sound echoing off the walls, the classroom was quiet as a dead squirrel. Only me and Cooter were smiling, because we both knowed this was just the start of the best day of schooling we were ever going to have. I looked over at Cooter, and he was looking just as happy as me. Mr. Travis opened his eyes and saw Cooter smiling away. And if I live to be 50 years old, I hope I don't never witness another grown man go berserk like Mr. Travis did. It was a sight and a scar that'll be with me the rest of my life, right along with that trouble twixt me and Mr. Frederick Douglass. The adventure got going so quick-like that I ain't sure of everything that happened. But all of a sudden, Mr. Travis was howling like a wolf and jumping clean across the classroom and pouncing on Cooter Bixby like an owl on a rat. He moved so fast that Cooter didn't even have a chance to get the smile off his face afore Mr. Travis jerked him out of his chair by the ear and marched him to the front of the room. I was shocked and couldn't have moved if I wanted to. Some of the other children weren't in as much shock as me, and soon as Mr. Travis clamped down on Cooter's ear, they made a dash toward the doors. You can't blame them neither. Ain't nothing in the world that can get you more fired up than watching your Sabbath school teacher get took over by Satan and commence twisting the juices out of children's ears, which is probably the first step the devil takes when he's about to wrestle your soul away from you. Before anyone could reach a door, Mr. Travis called out, "Return to your seats this instant." Everyone stopped where they were at and commenced heading back to their desks, all except for Johnny Wells, who screamed like a haint had got a hold of him and jumped right out the window. The last I saw him, Johnny was tearing down the road toward the square, raising up little clouds of dust as he ripped along. Once everyone got sitting again, Mr. Travis kept a hold of Cooter's ear and shouted louder than you'd figured a proper man like him should.
Our people are still enslaved and treated like animals.
Cooter couldn't tell that Mr. Travis had lost his mind. He was still smiling and nodding. And I knowed why, too. Cooter ain't the sharpest tooth on the saw, and he must have figured that if we were going to get a family breeding contest lesson, then getting your ear pulled on a little bit weren't too much a price to pay. Like I said, I ain't trying to say I'm smarter than Cooter, but I do study on things a little better and carefuler than he does, and I could see there weren't going to be no kind of lessons on nothing till Mr. Travis was done dusting off Cooter Bixby and dusting him off good. It ain't no real sign that I'm a fragile boy, but now I was sitting like all the other children. My hands were gripping on tight to the side of my desk, my breathing was coming raggedy, and my eyes were locked on Mr. Travis, wondering how long 'twas going to be afore he got back in his right mind. And if his mind didn't come back to him, I was wondering whose soul he was going to grab next. Mr. Travis said, "They are treated like animals."
and though a very few fortunate ones of us know the sweetness of freedom. Unfortunately, another very, very...
Each time Mr. Travis said very, he gave Cuda's ear a good little twist.
Very.
Cuda's ear was getting wound up so tight that he started dancing on one leg trying to get some of the pressure off it. But he was still smiling.
Very.
I couldn't stand it no more. Why, if Mr. Travis kept on twisting Cuda's ear like that, when he did turn it loose, it'd be spinning and unwinding itself on the side of Cuda's head for a whole week. I didn't care if it drawed attention to me or not. Cuda's my best friend, and I knowed he'd do the same for me. I took in a deep breath to buck up my courage, and finally raised my hand and yelled out, "Mr. Travis, sir, please forgive me for talking out in class, but I just gotta let Cuda know, if he don't quit smiling, sir, he's gonna end up getting that ear ripped right off from the side of his head." Cuda heard me through his other ear and catched on to what a bad spot he was in. Finally, he stopped smiling and started in howling. But Mr. Travis gave him a couple of more verys anyway.
Very, very few of us don't have an appreciation of whence we have come.
Cuda yelled, "I appreciate it. I appreciate it." Mr. Travis said,
"Oh, you do?"
Cuda screamed, "Oh, sir, you can't know how much I do." Mr. Travis said,
"And where, may I ask, was your appreciation of that fact this Saturday past at the sawmill?"
You could tell Cuda didn't have no kind of answer. But something about getting your ear twisted must make your mind work real clear. Cuda said,
"I'm sorry. I don't know what I done, but I'm powerful sorry, sir."
Mr. Travis eased back a notch on Cuda's ear and tells him,
"Read what's on the blackboard, Mr. Bixby."
Cuda didn't even look. He called out,
"It's a family breeding contest, sir."
He couldn't help but notice the surprised look on Mr. Travis's face, so he decided he'd best add some more. He said,
"And I don't care what happens, sir. I ain't gonna breathe a word to no one if you teaches us about that. But look at them there girls. You know Emma Collins is gonna snitch."
Mr. Travis commenced twisting on Cuda's ear some more. He told Emma,
"Miss Collins, read what I've written on that blackboard."
Emma jumped up like she sat on a tack and said,
"Sir, it says familiarity breeds contempt, sir."
Then Emma started in with her bawling. Me and Cuda both were surprised at this. Not about Emma bawling. That girl cry if you ask her what's two and two. We were surprised that Emma Collins, being as smart and fragile as she is, would be brave enough to call them words out right in front of everyone.
"Miss Collins,
you may be seated."
"Mr. Bixby, do you understand what that means?"
Cuda thought on it for a second, then said,
"Well, sir, I thought I did, but now I'm thinking that maybe Elijah gave me some bad information."
I couldn't believe it. Here I'd help save Cuda's ear, and the first chance he got to throw me to the wolves, he did it.
Mr. Travis said, "It's quite obvious you have no idea. It means once a person, let's say a person like you."
Mr. Travis went back at the ear twisting.
"Once a person feels too comfortable around someone who is his elder, or his superior, or his teacher,"
Cuda went back to howling,
"that person has a tendency to not treat his better with the respect that's due."
Cuda got it now.
"What did I do, sir? I didn't do nothing."
Mr. Travis said, "That's exactly it, Mr. Bixby. You did nothing. When you met me at the sawmill, you did not remove your hat when you walked up to me and spoke. You did not wait until I was finished talking to Mr. Polite. You did not address me in the proper manner.
Cuda said, But sir, I was surprised and happy to see you. I didn't say nothing but, hey, Mr. Travis.
Mr. Travis's mind left him again, and he started winding Cuda's ear back up.
That's it. Hey, hey, hey.
Now, hey was the word Mr. Travis used every time he gave Cuda's ear a crank.
Hey? Last time I checked, Mr. Bixby, hay was for horses, not for one's instructor. I've grown angrier and angrier. You are so fortunate to be freed from the yoke of slavery. You have this wonderful opportunity to improve who you are. And instead, you choose to behave toward me in a manner one would expect of a poor, ignorant soul who has lived his entire life in bondage.
It was about this time that the door flew open, and Mr. Chase came busting in, toting a broad axe, and dragging a screaming, kicking Johnny Wells behind him. Johnny was yelling,
Please, sir, don't make me go back in there. He already killed Cuda Bixby.
Mr. Chase looked round the classroom, saw Mr. Travis, brung his axe down, then said to Johnny Wells,
If you ever drag me out of the fields over some nonsense like this again, boy, I'm going to hide you, then give you to your pa so he can do the same. Do you see any Hanks in here? Do you see anyone what's dead in here?
Mr. Chase pulled off his cap and looked back at Mr. Travis twisting, and Cuda dancing, and said,
I give you my regrets for coming in here like this, sir. You can carry on with your lesson.
Things got pretty bad after that. We didn't learn nothing about no family breeding contests, and Mr. Travis commenced handing out lines as punishment and licks as reminders.
I got 3 swats and had to write familiarity breeds contempt 25 times for speaking out in class, and for providing Cuda with bad information on what it meant.
Johnny Wells got 5 swats and had to write it 50 times for running off and snitching on the teacher. Cuda got 10 licks and had to write it 125 times for being what Mr. Travis called riddled with disrespect for his superiors. Unfairest of all, since Cuda was my best friend, I knowed I was going to have to help him out. So I'd probably end up writing 50 of his doggone lines myself. I knowed the reason why Mr. Travis went and made us write all them lines and passed out all them swats. It was 'cause he was trying to make the familiarity breeds contempt lesson stick. But classroom learning just don't work the same as when something happens to you personal. That ain't to say that the lesson ain't gonna be with me for the rest of my life. But it don't have a thing to do with Mr. Travis. 'Cause it weren't but a few days later that the lesson got taught to me in a way that can't help but last forever.
Chapter 7 Mr. Leroy shows how to really make a lesson stick.
The on-again and off-again clouds got to be always on, and they ended up blacking out the moon 2 nights later. Since it's dangerous to work with an axe when there ain't no light at all, Mr. Leroy figured he had to lay off his work early. It ain't our usual custom. Most nights he kept on working till long after I was home and sleeping, but this night we started walking together out of Mrs. Holton's field. I don't work nowhere near as hard as Mr. Leroy, but that don't matter. I was good and tuckered out. Betwixt schooling and studying and choring round the settlement and working till past dark with him for most of the last couple weeks, I'll own up that I was lagging that night, and my mind might not have been quite right. That ain't to make no excuses about what happened. It's just telling the truth. Most times me and Mr. Leroy don't say much whilst we work. Not only because it's hard to talk to someone that's knocking away at trees and swinging a heavy axe, but also because Mr. Leroy don't seem partial to running his mouth nohow. To my way of thinking, that meant us walking home together was a good time to get a whole lot of the conversating done that we'd been missing out on. Most every other night, I gotta walk home by myself, and I ain't complaining. But sometimes, it does seem like the walking would be a lot easier if I had someone to do it with. It ain't no sign of being a fragile boy, but if you have to walk home on a night where the moon's got blacked out, you just might get surprised and find yourself jumping at noises coming from the side of the road or from out the woods and then running all the way home screaming. Anybody that has some sense would be a little afeard that one of those bears or snakes or wolves might have wandered out of their regular area and come over here. So maybe twixt the being real tired from all my work and the being real happy about having some company, my mind didn't have no chance of being right that night when the moon was covered and Mr. Leroy and me walked home together. Since he weren't much of a talker, I figured he had plenty of practice on being a listener, and I was jawing at him pretty regular and fast. Even though it happened 2 whole days ago, I was still mighty worked up about Mr. Travis near snatching Cooter's ear off and not teaching us about family breeding contests. So after I talked for a while about fishing and animals in the woods and Maul scratchy sweaters and how many first place ribbons Champion and Jingle Boy got at the fair, I started in on what happened when I got all those lines forced at me. Whilst we were walking for the first mile or so, Mr. Leroy would grunt and nod his head every once in a while, like he was paying some mind to what I was saying. But by the time I started in on talking about Mr. Travis, we covered us 2 miles easy, and Mr. Leroy weren't showing no kind of interest in nothing I was having to say. He just tromped on ahead, looking like he was wishing I'd be quiet. But like I already owned up to, lots of things were coming together to make me want to talk and not pay too much mind to who it was I was talking to. I said, "And Mr. Travis went berserk. And afore you can blink, he jumps clean across the room, and I can't say how he did it, but he must have been flying, because to get at Cuda Bixby, he had to go over 3 rows of children, and didn't one of them desk get knocked aside, nor toppled over, nor didn't one of them children have no footprints on them, nor bruises from where he must have stabbed." I could tell Mr. Leroy didn't particularly want to hear all this. He didn't tell me to be still, but he did pick up the pace of his walking like he was rushing to get home. I was about to miss the chance to get this off my chest, so I started halfway running and halfway walking to keep up with him. I told him, "So Mr. Travis has got Cooter's ear wound up so tight that it's starting to look like somebody's finger instead of somebody's ear, and it's about the most awful thing you ever seen in all your days." Then I said him. I said those words that made it so the lesson about familiarity and contempt will be fixed in my mind for as long as I live, even if that's to 50. I said, "And me and all them other little Nick." I knowed better. Ma and Pa didn't tolerate no one saying that word around them. They say it's a sign of hatred when a white person says it, and a sign of bad upbringing and ignorance when one of our own calls it out. So there ain't no good excuses. I knowed better. I didn't think Mr. Leroy was paying me no mind. I didn't even get the chance to get the whole word out. I never even saw it coming. It felt like whatever rope it was that was holding up the moon gave out all of a sudden, and the moon slipped free and busted through the clouds and came crashing down to earth before it exploded square on top of me. All I saw at first was a bright light, which I figured was Mr. Leroy backhanding me across my mouth. Then I felt my senses flying away, which must have been me falling toward the ground. Then I felt like I'd been chunked by the moon, which would have been me knocking my head against the ground. I don't think I was out for more than a second, but when I came to, I wished I'd been out for a whole lot longer, because Mr. Leroy was standing over top of me with his hand drawn back, fixing to crack me all over again. He made up for all that not talking he'd been doing whilst we walked. Now he commenced jawing at me just as hard as I'd been jawing at him. He shouted, "Is you out your mind?" I was about to say, "No, sir." But I figured this was one of them questions people ask just for the sake of asking it. They don't really want no answer. I probably couldn't have said nothing no way. My tongue was too busy roaming round my mouth, checking to see if any of my teeth had got set or loose by Mr. Leroy's slap. He said, "What do you think they called me whilst they was doing this?" He opened the front of his shirt and showed me where a big square with a letter T in the middle of it was branded into him. The scar was raised up and shiny and was real plain to see even if there weren't no moonlight at all. "What do you think they call me?" Mr. Leroy was screaming like it was him that lost his mind. "What do you think they call my girl when they sold her? What kind of baby they call her from up on the block?" Mr. Leroy was spitting and looking mad as a hatter. I sure was glad he'd gone and dropped his axe when he'd first busted me across the mouth. I said, "Mr. Leroy, sir, I'm sorry."
"What name you think they call my wife when they take her to another man for his own? What?"
"I'm sorry, sir, I'm sorry.
How you gonna call them children in that school and yourself that name them white folks down home calls us? Has you lost your natural mind? You wants to be like one of them? You wants to be keeping they hate alive?"
I saw that Mr. Leroy really was out of his mind. He must have thought I was a white person that said that word. I begged him, "Mr. Leroy, sir, please, I ain't white. Please, don't hit me no more." He raised his left hand, and I closed my eyes and tried to mash myself down into the dirt. He said,
"White person? You thinking this here is about some white person? Look at this. Look."
I opened my eyes and saw he wasn't gonna slap me again. He was showing me where his little finger on his left hand used to be. He was pointing at all that was left there, a little stump. He said,
"Who do you think it was? Cut my finger off. Who?"
I didn't know if I should answer him or just keep quiet and let him have his say. I shrugged my shoulders. He said,
"A slave. That's who." And the whole time, he's slashing and stabbing at me, trying to cut my throat. "What name he calling me? What name?"
I said, "I know, sir, but I ain't gonna say it no more." He said,
"You think just 'cause that word come out from twixt your black lips it means anything different? You think it ain't choked up with the same kind of hate and disrespect it has when they say it? You can't see it being even worse when you call it out?"
I told him, "Sir, I only said it 'cause I hear lots of children say it."
"What difference it make who you hear say it? I can understand a little if one of y'all freeborn use it. Y'all's ignorant in a whole slew of ways. Y'all ain't been told your whole life that's what you is. But someone what was a slave, or someone whose ma and pa was a slave and raised them good like y'all done, that just shows you believe in that what we be. That just shows you done swallowed they poison and swallowed it whole."
There weren't gonna be no more hitting. I could tell Mr. Leroy was calming down. He commenced rubbing on his left arm, then reached his hand down to help me up. Once I got up, I quick wiped away the tears that were trying to get in my eyes. It ain't being fragile. But don't nothing in the world make you want to bawl more than getting a good backhand slap when you ain't expecting it. Mr. Leroy said,
Now, Belton, you like that probably wasn't the right thing to do, Lige, but I ain't sorry I done it. If my boy Ezekiel was to call someone out their name like that, I praise the God someone would bust him up to. Y'all young folks gotta understand, that's a name what ain't never called with nothing but hate. That ain't nothing but a word them slavers done chained us with, and if God's just, like I know he is, one day it gonna be buried right along with the last one of them. That ain't one of the things we need to be carrying to Canada with us. Now, if you and me's don't do any more working together, you know what you gotta say.
I did. I told him, I'm sorry, Mr. Leroy. I ain't never gonna use that word again. He said,
You got to always keep in mind, Elijah, that I'm grown and you ain't. You got to always remember that we gets along just fine, but I ain't your friend. I cares about you like you's my own boy, but you always got to give me my respect. You saying that word ain't showing no respect for me. It ain't showing no respect for your folks. It ain't showing no respect for yourself. And it ain't showing no respect for no one what's had that word spit on them whilst they's getting beat on like an animal.
Mr. Leroy used his hat to brush the back of my shirt and my pants off and reached his hand out for me to shake it, then said,
Elijah, it's my hope that there ain't no hard feelings tricks you and me. I likes the way you owned up to what you done.
I shook his hand and said, No, sir, ain't no hard feelings at all. Some of the time, when a grown person asks you a question, you're smart to tell them what it is they want to hear. But that wasn't what I was doing. I said there weren't no hard feelings because I meant it. Paul's always telling me that people that used to be slaves are toting things round with them that can't be seen with your regular eyes. He says once someone was a slave, there's always going to be a something in them that knows parts about life that freeborn folks can't never know, mostly horrific parts. He tells me that's why I got to be sharp on my guard when I'm talking with anyone that got free. They've seen people acting in ways that can't help but leave scars and peculiarities. Things that I might not think mean nothing, but things that can cut them to the quick. So I wasn't doing nothing but telling Mr. Leroy the truth when I told him I wasn't holding no grudges and that I wasn't going to use that word again. He said,
Good, son. Because I really want you to know what I'm trying to say, and sometimes I ain't too good with my words.
I said, I know what you're trying to say, Mr. Leroy. It boils down to familiarity breeds contempt. Mr. Leroy picked up his axe and swung it across his left shoulder, then put his right hand on my head. I'll always remember Mr. Leroy's hand on my head and the words he told me. I'll always remember that night when there weren't no moon and me and Mr. Leroy walked home together.
Chapter 8. The most exciting night of my life so far.
The next day after school, I was in the stable shoveling manure when old Flapjack gave a snort. I looked up, and the preacher was standing in the doorway.
Evening, Elijah.
Evening, sir.
Do you remember when I asked if you'd be willing to do something to help the settlement?
Yes, sir.
Have you changed your mind?
About what, sir?
helping the settlement.
Why, no, sir, but what was it that... The preacher unfolded a piece of paper and handed it to me. Coming to Chatham, 3 nights only, Sir Charles M. Vaughan and his world-renowned Carnival of Oddities will be traversing through Canada West on their way from Chicago, Illinois, to Buffalo, New York, and points east. Sir Charles has graciously agreed to allow the citizens of Chatham, Buxton, and nearby environs to witness for themselves what they have only read about in the nation's finest newspapers. Hear the calliope. Taste the sugar treats. See the most unusual freaks of nature you can imagine. Witness the world's greatest hypnotist. Rare patent medicines available. Games of chance. Members of all races welcome. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday only. Coot had already told me about this carnival, but he made the mistake of asking his ma if he could go. She'd ask him if he was daft, then said she was going to make sure he didn't sneak out by having him sleep at the foot of her bed on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I told the preacher, all the grown folks said, we got to stay away from this. They said there's gambling and all sorts of horrible things going on there. He said, so what do you think about it? I've thought of a way we can use your God-given gift to help get some money for the settlement. But if you're having second thoughts, but Ma and Pa would never let me go to something like this. Elijah, there are lots of things that you do that I'm sure your mother and father would be shocked about. I'm positive they have no idea how much time you and Cuda spend wandering about in the forest late at night, do they? This wouldn't be much different than that. It would simply be a matter of meeting me later tomorrow night, and then the two of us going to the carnival. I'd be there to make certain nothing bad happened to you. But if you've changed your mind about helping the settlement, I understand. It's easy to talk about being helpful, but actually doing what one has promised can be a whole lot more difficult. I saw what the preacher was doing. I saw how he was using grown folks' talk to paint me in a corner. But the way I look at things, there's accidentally getting painted in a corner, and there's not minding getting painted in a corner. And truth told, I didn't mind getting painted into this one. What could be more exciting than going to a carnival to see freaks of nature and watch someone get hypnotized? Plus, the preacher had figured out a way for me to help the settlement, too. What could be better? But I ain't got no money to get in, sir. Elijah, your money is no good when I'm around. Besides, if you insist on paying me back, you can always double up on your tithing when you go fishing. It weren't for myself exactly. It was for the good of the settlement. So I said, when should I meet you, sir? That's my boy. We'll meet tomorrow night. Bring a sack full of your stones. As interesting as this was starting to sound, there weren't no way I was going to miss going to this carnival. On Friday night, me and the preacher first came to a clearing that was a bit off from the main set of noise and excitement. In the middle of the clearing was a tent that had a big, fresh, painted sign out front that said, See Madame Sabar, the royal huntress from Sweden. She has slain 541 Swedish moth lions with no weapon other than her slingshot. A white man with a walking stick and a straw hat stood on a box, shouting to people to pay a dime to come see this hunting woman. He yelled,
Marvel at the deadly accuracy of Madame Sabar's slingshot. Come one, come all. You will be amazed at the things she can do with a simple stone. You will want to come back again and again. Your friends and neighbors won't believe you when you tell them about the power that Madame Sabar's simple weapon possesses. Witness for yourself the astounding little lady who has killed 541 of the fiercest beasts in all of Europe, the dreaded Swedish moth lion.
One of the white farmers called out,
"That's a load of hogwash. There ain't no lions in Sweden."
The white man pointed his walking stick at the farmer and said,
"You're absolutely right, sir, which is further proof of Madame Sabar's skill. It shows she's wiped out the entire lot of them. Now you'll have to hurry. Our next-to-last show begins in 2 minutes. Who's going to pay the ridiculously small sum of one thin dime to see this amazing woman?"
I couldn't believe it. The preacher pulled me into the line, and we waited to go in and see this woman. I started shaking right off. I had never seen no one who'd killed a lion afore. I had never seen no one that's ever seen a lion afore. When we got to the front of the line, the preacher put down 2 American dimes, and we went into the tent. We sat on a row of benches right up near the front of the stage. On one end of the stage, there were 5 bull's-eye targets. Next to the targets was a big board that had a thick, dark green forest painted on it. You could tell there wasn't no forest from around here, 'cause these woods had monkeys hanging in the trees. There were also 6 holes the size of supper plates cut into the board, so as it appeared to be a big knot hole in each one of the trees. Under each one of the holes was a fancy writ number going from 1 to 6. Across the top of the board, spaced the same distance one from the another, were 10 lit candles, and under the candles, it looked like someone had thrown a sheet over the very top of the board. The sheet said, "The Jungles of Sweden." We didn't wait but a minute afore the white man with the walking stick and straw hat came out on stage and told some jokes that didn't no one think were funny. After he saw he wasn't going to encourage nothing but hisses from the crowd, he introduced us to the slingshot lady, and fierce looking as she was, it was easy to tell she really had killed 500 lions. The man said,
"Please, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, help me welcome Madame Sabar, and perhaps she will show us her dexterity with these deadly slingshots."
The man pointed at a table that had on top of it 3 fancy slingshots. Next to the slingshots were little piles of things I figured the woman was going to shoot. There were some grapes and some peculiar-looking stones with holes in them, and some real pretty marbles, and some rocks that looked a little too light to be proper chunking stones. A tiny amount of clapping came out the crowd, and Madame Sabar picked up one of the slingshots and one of the marbles. She aimed at the first bull's-eye target and shot off a marble. It hit dead center and busted through some paper and rung the bell. She did the same thing with the next 4 targets, ringing a bell every time. Folks didn't think this was such a big ruckus, especially not one worth paying no whole American dime for. Only 1 or 2 people clapped, but there was a lot more grumbling and hissing going on, too. The man said,
"Astonishing! Astounding! But it doesn't end there, ladies and gentlemen. Once she has prepared herself, she moves on to a more challenging task. It is a well-known fact that the Swedish moth lion is drawn to candlelight. So once the roar of one of these fierce Scandinavian cats is heard, Madame Sabar's first duty is to extinguish all of the candles as quickly as she possibly can.
The man put his hand on his ear and said, "Hark!
What was that?"
All of a sudden, it looked like we were going to get our dime's worth after all. Somewhere from behind the stage came a roar that sounded like Mr. Brown clearing phlegm out of his throat, but a lot louder. And Madame Sabar sprung to work. She picked up a different slingshot, and all sorts of Who Struck John busted loose. First thing she did was aim at the tin candle sitting atop of the board with the six holes. She was using the odd-looking stones with holes in them, and when they flew across the tent, they made a sound like one of them fat, lazy Buxton bumblebees. Once the buzzing stones got to the candles, they put the flame out quiet as a whisper. One or one of them candles disturbed neither. The only thing that moved on each one was the wick. Why, with the tent getting fooled up with the buzzing of tin stones and the flames getting snuffed out one after the another, 'twas a sight I'd have paid one of my own dimes to see. But what she did next topped even that. She turned the slingshot out at all of us in the crowd and commenced firing over our heads, putting out all the candles that runned round the tent. Seems like thinking you're about to get busted in the head with a buzzing stone and not having it happen makes you want to give a good old whoop. Folks that ducked down or throwed their arms atop their heads came right back up cheering and clapping. Madame Sabar gave one of them lady curtsies. The man said, "Did I mislead you? Did I not tell you you'd be amazed? But oh, ye of little faith, the story is not even half told." The man pointed his walking stick at the board with the jungle and the six knot holes. "For not only must Madame Sabar be on the lookout for the dreaded Swedish moth lion, she must also keep a sharp watch for the lion's allies, the savage members of the Swedish Mobongo tribe, and especially the young chief of the tribe, Maui." From behind the holy board came a set of screams and yelps and jibber-jabber. Then a little white boy, hanging on to a spear and sporting a big old soup bone on top of his head, marched onto the stage. The only clothes he was wearing was the bottom half of a woman's dress that looked like it weren't nothing but a bunch of long leaves sewed together. On his cheeks were painted black stripes. He was hopping from one foot to the other while someone banged on a drum. If he'd have done it any faster and with any kind of rhythm, it would have come pretty close to being dancing.
"Beware, Madame Sabar," the man shouted. "Young Maui is very angry because he knows of your reputation."
The boy shook his spear at the slingshot lady, but instead of being angry, the look on his face made it seem he was afeard.
"But what is this?" "Oh, no. Maui has used some of his conjuring powers on Madame Sabar and has rendered her blind."
The little boy reached in a bag on his waist and throwed something all sparkling and flashing at the woman. The white man with the walking stick tied a blindfold round Madame Sabar's face, then pulled a cloth sack over that so as we could tell she weren't seeing a thing.
"And now that he has blinded her, Maui will hide behind one of the trees in the Swedish jungle and most foully lie in wait for an ambush."
The man turned the slingshot lady so she was facing the board with the holes in it direct. Maui walked behind it. But afore he went, I got a good look at him. This weren't no Swedish jungle chief at all. This was Jimmy Blassingame, one of the white children from Chatham that studied at our school. The man said, "Madame Sabar, what can you see?" The woman raised the sack so her mouth weren't covered and said, "Alas, I see nothing. The heathen's magic has left me completely sightless."
The man said, "Oh, woe! And look at the cowardly savage! He's preparing to attack! What shall we do? How shall we save this innocent white woman? I can give her a weapon, but in her state, how shall she use it?"
The man reached onto the table next to Madame Sabar and put a different slingshot in her left hand. In her right hand, he put a bunch of the purple grapes. She plucked one of them and set it in the sling. All of a sudden, Jimmy Blassingame's face popped out of the hole that had the fancy 3 writ underneath it, the last hole on the right in the top row. The man screamed, "Madame Sabar, the coward is attacking! Fire your weapon!" Madame Sabar lifted the slingshot and let one of them fat purple grapes fly. It splashed on the side of the tent, 5 feet above Jimmy's head. "Oh, no, she is blinded. And look, the savage is moving to another spot from which to waylay this innocent white maiden." Jimmy's head came out of hole number 5, which was on the bottom row in the middle of the board.
"I've got it," the walking stick man yelled. "You good citizens of Chatham can help by calling out the number of the hole in which that black-hearted barbarian is hiding."
Jimmy's face showed up in the last hole on the right, in the bottom row, and about half the crowd shouted, "6! Why, that hunting lady couldn't see a thing, but she shot one of them grapes so fast and true that it caught Jimmy square in the middle of his forehead. He ducked his head, so that was all that was poking out of the hole. Everybody laughed so hard that the tent shook. Jimmy went to hole number 5, hole number 4, hole number 1, and hole number 3. And every time his forehead popped out, the crowd snitched on him, and Madame Sabar gave him the same treatment. After a while, all the grapes that got smashed on Jimmy's forehead started leaking down into his eyes, so he bended over to wipe at him. But when he did this, he was right in front of the 5th hole, and the crowd shouted, 5! Madame Sabar raised a slingshot and fired the next grape so straight that it catched Jimmy, who hadn't had no chance at all to bend his face down, right twixt his eyes. And when a person more shocked by this than Jimmy Blassingame, his mouth came wide open. He stood up. His face was now in front of the 2nd hole, and doggone it all, some of the rotten folks in the crowd hollered out, 2! Madame Sabar quick shot another grape, and it disappeared down Jimmy's throat, making a sound like a soap bubble getting busted. Jimmy's hands came up to his neck, and he staggered out from behind the board with the jungle in the holes and started flopping around on stage like a fish tossed out of water. The man with the walking stick commenced cursing and saying words I ain't never heard afore. He picked Jimmy up and gave him a squeeze round the middle. The grape popped out of Jimmy's mouth and rolled out into the crowd. You'd have thought 'twere a funnier thing in the world had ever happened. Even the preacher, who most times is a pretty serious man, took to throwing his head back and howling. Jimmy Blassingame didn't even have sense enough to get off the stage. He sat plumb up there where the man had dropped him and cried so hard that purple and black streaks ran down his cheeks and splashed onto his chest. It sure was a good thing for Jimmy that I was the only one from school who saw this. Sitting there with purple and black streaks running down his chest and bawling while swearing half a woman's leaf dress was the kind of thing that no one wouldn't let him forget about for years. It would have got tied up with his name same way mine's tied up with Mr. Frederick Douglass. The man with the straw hat and walking stick pointed at Madame Sabar and said,
"Please, give yourselves a hand for saving the purity of this poor white damsel, and let us show our appreciation for the most accurate hunter to ever roam the jungles of Sweden."
Everybody except for me, the preacher, and Jimmy Blassingame clapped and hollered and whistled hard as they could. The preacher leaned down and yelled,
There's one more person I have to talk to, and pulled me out of the tent.
Chapter 9 The Mesmerist and Sammy.
Me and the preacher walked through a patch of woods toward the sounds that were cutting through the night air. When we stepped into the Atlas clearing, it was like we fell off a cliff right into a whole nother world. What I saw was so shocking that at first everything on me acted like it wanted to draw up and squeeze together. The same way your body does if you're walking across some ice that gives way and dumps you into froze-up winter water. It was like it was too much coming at you all at once, like it would steal your breathing away from you. But I think that's what the carnival folks were trying to do. Everything in the Atlas clearing was set up to get your head started whirling and keep it going that way, and there weren't no hiding from none of it. Every part of my body was trying to grab attention away from the next part. My ears were steady picking up sounds that I had never heard nowhere else. There were hoops and hollers from children and grown folks both. Screams that had you thinking someone was looking death right in the throat, but that quick turn to laughs that were kind of shame-sounding. There was a powerful hissing music, whistling from a wagon that was throwing fog and songs out of a row of pipes, sounding so hot and hard and pointy that you'd have thought you took a knife and were scratching at something deep inside your ear. But soon as it felt like the sounds were going to cause your head to bust open, your eyes started taking over and noticing separate things out of what at first didn't appear to be nothing but a blur of color and torches. There were more of the walking stick-holding, straw hat-wearing white men singing out for you to come see what they had hid up in their tents. They kept calling out the same words over and over, sounding like the choir on Sunday, but without no real feeling of happiness in the words. There were bright red and blue and green and yellow banners, strung up alongside dull brown, high-reaching tents. On the banners were pictures of things that you had to pay a whole nickel to go in and get a look at. Why, terrible as those pictures were, I'd have paid a nickel to not go in and see him. There was a painting of a white man that appeared to be half a human and half an alligator, joined up so as you couldn't tell if what you were seeing was the rear half of an alligator swallowing up the top half of a man, or if it was a man that had been born without no legs, who had sewed the back half of a lizard onto himself to see if maybe he could do some walking that way. There was a picture of a white woman that looked like she had some child's arms and legs poking out of the side of her neck. And another white man that was picking up a full-grown elephant and holding it over his head like he was about to toss it into the next county. Another banner showed a white man that was wide as a barn, holding hands with a white woman that weren't much more than a stick with a hank of yellow hair on top. They were standing under a big red heart that said, Bizarre Love. But the drawing that I knowed would keep me awake nights and discourage me from wandering around in the woods for a good long time was the one of a white man who had to be a conjurer. He didn't have no animal parts stuck on him, nor no parts of other people growing out of him that would invite staring. He had something worst, something that I tried hard to look away from, but weren't no way I could do it. He had sharp, yellow, jaggedy-looking bolts of lightning shooting direct out of his eyes. The bolts were making the normal-looking white man in the picture with him float off his feet and scramble and scratch at the air like he was about to drift up to the clouds. It would cost you a whole quarter of American dollar to go in the tent and see the conjurer do this. I'd have gave 2/4 of a dollar not to. But sure as shooting, this was the other person the preacher said we were going to have to go see. He pointed at the drawing of the man with the lightning bolt eyes and said, He's the owner of the carnival. I want to get a look at what kind of rigmarole he's got going before I talk to him. Another straw hat wearing,
walking stick-waving white man, was out front of the tent calling,